Okay, it is 9:02 by my official clock. Casey, can you mute these lines,
please? Conference muted.
All right, well, good morning, everybody. This is the last telebrief in November, and we are moving into December. Hard to believe. Okay, lots to report on this morning. I think in the last telebrief that I had, I reported that there had been a bill introduced in the Senate on October the 15th by Senators Murphy, he's the Democrat from Connecticut, and Senator Young, the Republican from Indiana, called the 2019 Workforce Mobility Act, which in effect would ban non-compete agreements under most circumstances. Well, on November the 14th, so just a couple weeks ago, the U.S. Senate Committee on Small Business and Entrepreneurship held a hearing on this introduced bill. And surprisingly, it got some bipartisan support. There were a couple speakers who testified regarding this bill. One was a fellow named Evan Starr, S-T-A-R-R, who actually is an assistant professor of management and organization at the University of Maryland School of Business down in College Park. And what Professor Starr testified to was largely in support of the Workforce Mobility Act. And he, along with another witness, testified that they believed that less intrusive means could be utilized by employers to protect business interests, such as non-solicitation agreements, confidentiality agreements, and trade secret laws, things that I've talked about in prior telebriefs as sort of less drastic and aggressive forms of employer protection than total non-compete agreements. And one of the things they also recommended was that if there were going to be any non-compete agreements that would be permitted, that employers would be obligated to pay employees for the so-called shelf time that they would be out of the market during the period of the non-compete. So I think it's an interesting development, and I'm a little surprised at some of the bipartisan support on this. You would think that this would mostly be the support of the Democratic caucus, but it does seem to have some Republican traction, and I'm sure we'll hear more about this in 2020. I'll keep you updated, but I wanted to bring this to your attention for those of you who either have existing non-competes or are contemplating the use of non-competes in the future, at least for managerial employees. As you know, in Maryland, and I've stated this on several occasions, in Maryland, you can no longer have non-compete agreements for rank-and-file, non-exempt employees. Okay. Second, those of you who have been on telebriefs, you know, we've spent a lot of time during 2019 talking about the new exempt salary levels that will be in effect come January. That is January 1st of 2020. Many of you out there need to make sure that if you are currently classifying any individual as exempt, that they must meet the new exempt test as of January the 1st, 2020, and that if you decide that people who are making less than that new salary level are not going to be brought up to that level, that they be converted to non-exempt employees. And, of course, that has both morale and legal implications to what you're going to be doing from a wage hour perspective. And if they're going to be non-exempt, then, of course, they'd have to be notified that in order to be in compliance with the Fair Labor Standards Act, they'd have to be paid time and a half for any hours spent or worked over 40 in a particular work week. So I leave that to you. You may want to take a look at your job descriptions, make sure that they meet the duties test. if in fact you're increasing the salary level to bring them in compliance with the FLSA. But not only is there a salary requirement, but as you know, there's a duties test for those classified as administrative, executive, computer, or professional employees. Okay, wanted to move on. I had a client about a week and a half ago who really was inquiring with regard to how to go about conducting an in-house workplace investigation. And there are certain things that need to be done, and those of you out there who regularly do these workplace investigations or who haven't done one in some period of time, I want to remind you that there are certain things, I think, to keep in mind when doing these workplace investigations, unless you outsource them to, let's say, your employment attorney or some other person. So let me mention several things that I would have on a checklist to validate your internal workplace investigation. So first, the employee who's bringing the complaint to you, which would merit a workplace investigation, and let's say a workplace harassment allegation, obviously you would want, under ideal circumstances, to get a written statement from that particular complainant, in which the complainant is asked to specify the names of any witnesses that that person may identify, particularly the specifics about the facts and dates of any incidents that led to the complaint being brought to your attention, and the identity of any specific tangible evidence, such as text, emails, telephone messages, etc., which may bear on a particular allegation. Now, you know, I think I've spoken about this before. I wouldn't insist as a precondition to conducting the investigation that it be in writing, but obviously, under ideal circumstances, you would want that complaint to be in writing. But keep in mind, verbal complaints are just as meritorious in terms of precipitating an investigation as a written statement from that complaining witness. Secondly, it's very important that you tell the witness or the complaining person that you have a non-retaliation policy in place and that you not promise confidentiality, at least in the absolute terms, that you just indicate to that person that while you can't guarantee confidentiality, you will protect it to the extent possible under the circumstances of the case. Thirdly, that hopefully you would gather during the investigation whatever tangible evidence would be appropriate, whether that, again, text messages, emails, phone messages, or, you know, security footage from cameras that you might have, anything that you think would be of use in advancing the investigation should be preserved and be requested from either the complaining witness or fact witnesses themselves. People always ask me, well, how long should the investigation take? Generally, I think workplace investigations need to be completed as quickly but as thoroughly as possible. So hopefully that would be within a matter of a couple days, maybe 2 or 3 days. But again, if particular witnesses are on vacation or on sick leave, etc., that may have to be extended. So there's no artificial barrier to an investigation lasting perhaps a week or two, but you certainly don't want to go out more than a week or two unless there really is an extreme extenuating circumstance. And next, you want to interview whatever salient witnesses that are identified as having information that will advance the inquiry. And again, like my statement on the complaining witness, in the ideal circumstance, you would want written statements from fact witnesses. But again, Some of those may not be willing to give written statements. In those circumstances, what you would do is hopefully at the end of your interview, you could read back your notes to the fact witness and ask that fact witness whether or not your notes are accurate and reflect the statements made by that particular witness. Also, your notes should be dated and they should be timed so that you have on your interview notes the date of the interview, the time of the interview, and how long the interview took. Next, obviously, at some point, you need to make a decision based on your conclusions of the interviews that you've made, the evidence that you've gathered. And in many cases, you're going to have to make credibility determinations. Those credibility determinations are made pretty much on a preponderance of the evidence standard, not a standard of beyond a reasonable doubt. And, you know, you're just going to have to make those determinations as if you were pretty much sitting in a jury in any kind of a civil case. That is, what is the preponderance of the evidence show you? Is it more likely than not that wrongdoing was established, or is it more likely than not that wrongdoing was not established? Under any circumstances, at the end of the day, you would theoretically meet with the complaining witness separately from the alleged perpetrator to announce your findings and make sure that you document your meetings with both and that you have a written investigatory summary, because frequently these investigations may be the subject of a legal claim down the road, and you want to be able to demonstrate that you conducted a thorough and efficient workplace investigation, and so that you would have, theoretically anyway, a pretty complete accounting of your investigation from beginning to end. And importantly, during the course of a workplace investigation, if in doubt as to what steps to take or how to take them, you would want to confer with your employment counsel in order to get his or her guidance for the completion of the investigation, as well as to shield certain communications, either under the attorney-client privilege or the attorney work product privilege itself. So I know that many of these statements or many of these things that I've just stated may be sort of old hat to you, to those of you who regularly conduct these investigations, but it never hurts to review these concepts for purposes of going forward for these workplace investigations. Okay. In the sort of realm of administrative agencies and what's up with them, I will tell you that the EEOC and the National Labor Relations Board and the Department of Labor all will be publishing in the very near future their positions, excuse me, on joint employer status. I've talked in the past about the National Labor Relations Board basically, I think, coming down with a joint employer rule or regulation, which will basically indicate that two employers will be deemed to be joint employers under the National Labor Relations Act, where one of the employers exerts substantial direct and immediate control, over the essential terms and conditions of employment, such as hiring or firing, discipline, et cetera, of the second company's employees. The Equal Employment Opportunity Commission's joint employer rule may be similar to the NLRB's, or it may be a little different, as may the Department of Labor's. But we'll see probably in early 2020 what those three agencies have to say on how they deem two employers to be the joint employer of a particular secondary employer. And that'll be an important thing to pay attention to. Also, with regard to the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, on November the 19th, the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission released what it called its agency financial report, or the acronym capital A, capital R, F, capital R for fiscal year 2019, in which they report on several aspects of its operations, political, financial, and otherwise. And this is under the chair, Janet Dillon. She was approved during 2019 as the new chair of the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. As I've reported on before, the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission itself is made up of five individuals, and that is the EEOC's chair, the vice chair, and three commissioners. Of the five members, three must be at least acting commissioners to satisfy a quorum and exercise their powers. And like the National Labor Relations Board, we now have a Republican-controlled Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. In terms of the finances, statistically, during fiscal year 2019, and that would be the year ending September the 30th, 2019, the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission reports that it recovered more than $486 million for alleged discrimination victims during that fiscal year. Significantly also, they report that during that fiscal year, they reduced the charge workload by an additional 12%, but that there are still pending charges in the amount of $43,850, which they report as the lowest level in 13 years. Some of you out there may have pending charges which have been in existence for months, if not a couple years. I know that I have some clients who have had position statements pending at the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission for 12 months or more. And usually that's not a problem, except in discharge cases where the back pay potential clock continues to run. Hopefully, in fiscal year 2020, the EEOC will proceed and will continue to reduce that backlog so that charges can be resolved one way or another in a more efficient and quick manner. And talking about things at the EEOC and dealing with the EEOC, I wanted to remind you, because I've had several situations during 2019 of clients who have had employees with mental health impairments, where those employees indicate that they have the need for FMLA leave or an ADA accommodation. And suffice it to say that under the ADA, mental health impairments are treated the same as physical health impairments under the ADA. That is, they are deemed to be disabilities under the Americans with Disabilities Act, and thereby precipitating the need for accommodations where appropriate. So mental health conditions, which have gotten a great deal of publicity recently, whether that is OCD or whether it's anxiety, depression, etc., are viewed as worthy of treatments of disabilities under the ADA, and certainly worthy of the need for either interactive dialogues between the employer and the employee for purposes of an accommodation, or sometimes where you simply don't have enough information as the employer from the employee's healthcare provider to enable you to determine whether or not there's a legitimate need for an accommodation or for what that accommodation may require. And I've been involved in several cases during 2019 where I've recommended that the employer go back to the employee and perhaps the employee's healthcare provider to get more specific information regarding whether or not under the job description of that particular employee that there is a need for more specific information. And there's always this question that I get from employers as to whether they are entitled to to get more information from the healthcare provider? And the answer to that is yes, if you need that information in order to enable you to make a determination as to whether or not there is a need for an accommodation. And if so, what is that accommodation like to be able to have the employer have the interactive dialogue with the employee to assess whether an accommodation can be made? And if so, whether it would place an undue burden on you as the employer, either from a cost standpoint or an operational standpoint, to implement that particular accommodation. So I suspect that in the upcoming year, you will get more of these kinds of requests or requests for FMLA or ADA support, either in the need for an accommodation or what that accommodation would look for. And you're simply going to have to take these on a case-by-case basis, but be aware of the fact that mental health and emotional health kinds of disability issues are just as prevalent, frankly, if not more prevalent today, than physical impairments, and you need to be cognizant of that and make your line supervision management aware of the fact that these are just as worthy of your time and attention than if they were physical accommodation issues. Okay, those are the developments for the day. Casey, can you take this off of mute, please?
All right.
Okay, well, if anybody has any questions or comments, happy to answer them now in this forum, or if you want to email me, as you know, my email is hkerman@offitkerman.com. Any questions?
I have a quick question on the review for accommodation. Is there a cadence at which it's appropriate to ask for additional information after you've certified that someone is eligible for a mental health accommodation? Is it a 6-month or an annual?
Well, is your question how long does an accommodation need to be honored once there's a legitimate need for an accommodation?
Yes.
Okay. So the answer to that is obviously it's determined on a case-by-case basis, and it really is dependent upon how long you can accommodate a particular accommodation without it imposing an undue burden on you. So, for instance, you may have an accommodation which says that in the next 4 weeks or 6 weeks, the employee needs to be able to work remotely from home in order to perform his or her duties and responsibilities. On the other hand, you may make an assessment that after 6 weeks, it's a real problem to accommodate that particular request. So the answer really is that it's an ongoing assessment on the part of the employer, and there's not an obligation to indefinitely accommodate a particular employee if doing so would impose an undue burden on you. So it's really an ongoing assessment. What may be reasonable for 6 weeks, for instance, may not be reasonable for 12 weeks. And that's something that you have to take a look at as the determining factor. Does that answer your question?
It does. Thank you very much.
Sure. Any other questions? Okay. Well, if not, the first telebrief in December will be December the 11th, Wednesday, December the 11th. And in the meantime, I hope everybody has a happy and safe and healthy Thanksgiving.
Same to you, Howard.
All right. Take care, everyone. Right out. Bye-bye.